listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sounding culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
Listen, I'm hearing Shakespeare. Taking four of Shakespeare's tragedies, Macbeth, Othello, Hamlet, and King Lear, I hear Shakespeare in and around another anachronistic soundscape, the blues. The space of this sonic experience is Yogi Ga Expression Gallery, a performance venue in Hongdae, a popular art and club scene in Seoul, Korea, for their Bulgasari, or Starfish, experimental improvisational performances. Charismatic is on percussion, Wang So-young reading, and me, Brooke Carlson, on the alto sax. Sounding Shakespeare's Soul was performed on January 26, 2013. I'm Assistant Professor of English Literature at Hankook University of Foreign Studies here in Seoul, and this project grows out of both critical engagement with Shakespeare and Shakespeare as a creative process. Moreover, this is a sonic project in sound studies, as defined by Jonathan Stern in his Sound Studies Reader. Sound Studies, and I quote, "redescribes what sound does in the human world and what humans do in the sonic world," end quote. So I'm asking you to think sonically, or as Stern puts it, and I quote, "to think sonically is to think conjuncturally about sound and culture," end quote. Stephen Feld and Donald Bernice, in Doing Anthropology and Sound, used the term acoustomology to describe, and I quote, "one's sonic way of knowing and being in the world," end quote. Sounding Shakespeare's Soul attempts to know and be Shakespeare today in Seoul. The roots of this project can also be found in Bruce R. Smith's The Acoustic World of Early Modern England, where Smith posits, and I quote, "listening as an ecological concern where ecology studies the conditions of inhabiting," end quote. Smith, too, uses acoustomology to get at an early modern England as a space of sonic transformation. And I like that, transformation. Like Smith, I argue here for a cultural presence as the experience or the phenomenon that is listening as communication. What's at stake, of course, is the play, embodiment, translation, gender, sex, race, class, Shakespeare, and sound. Shakespeare is often viewed and read as a kind of cultural elite, as a lofty and ambitious goal, or as something to be conquered or vanquished. For English as a second language learners, Shakespeare poses even greater challenges. In Korea's educational context, where test scores determine university entrance, study abroad opportunities, scholarships, and even job interviews and or jobs, Shakespeare is a writer who instills great fear and awe. How do you pass the Shakespeare test? Often, in the university, that can mean spending a semester getting at one, or maybe, possibly, perhaps several of Shakespeare's plays through 16 weeks of reading about and studying English early modern culture and history. This is different from the States, for example, where Shakespeare surveys tend to include as many of Shakespeare's plays as possible in 16 weeks, usually organized around a generic scheme, tragedy, history, comedy, romantic comedy, or thematic scheme, adaptation on film, love, emergence of the subject, etc. Shakespeare's English is further removed from the contemporary, which means even less familiar and more incomprehensible for today's readers, English as a second language and not. To better learn the plays, students read translations, modern-day revisions, plot summarizations, and then they view film and stage productions. From the BBC to Baz Luhrmann, Shakespeare in his time was performed, seen, heard, and experienced. So part of what follows is an attempt not to summarize, contextualize, or analyze Shakespeare's literary corpus, but rather to hear Shakespeare and to feel Shakespeare as something both familiar and unfamiliar. Melding the blues and Shakespeare, this project involves my writing short, page-length poems in contemporary English that contain a line or lines from a Shakespeare play, as well as the play's main ideas. Part of my task is bedding the Shakespeare passage in an English that is lyrical but untimely, in part so as to reproduce the strangeness of the bard. These lines are then laid across a bit of percussion built out of the playing of Shakespeare's books, literally. The rhythmic foundation is thus established upon a thing that didn't exist properly in Shakespeare's time. Shakespeare didn't publish books. He put on plays. Yet Shakespeare today is so central to reading. And finally, I use an alto saxophone and blues scale to improvise a bit of blues along with the percussion and the reading. In short, I'm querying Shakespeare by placing him in a blues bed, punctuated by the pounding of books, and dressed up in a Korean female voice. Let's listen.
Sounding Shakespeare, soul. Another from the King of Hands.
What you just heard, the syntax of the poem is standard, or what you heard makes sense, and Shakespeare is heard only as a phrase, or several of them, predominantly shuffle off this mortal coil. The rearticulation of what is a man, time is out of joint, and the play's the thing, the last one in particular with a British female and American male voice in unison, anchors the poem's soundscape, or acoustomology, in Shakespeare. The play, of course, is Hamlet, and these phrases are Hamlet's, yet they're manifest as a Korean female voice. The embodiment of Hamlet and of the bard is thus unmanned, even more so when the following movement with Macbeth will get there, and misgendered as female. The sound of the voice, moreover, is Asian and specifically Korean, asking the listener to think and rethink Hamlet and race. Race appears in the third word of the performance as Seoul, a play on the location, Seoul, and the thing the performance attempts to get at, Seoul. Where is Shakespeare's soul? Where is Shakespeare here? Can we hear Shakespeare any more now than we can when we read or see Shakespeare performed? Like Hamlet's famous soliloquy, the poem begins in a space of contemplation and self-analysis. The self sounds not himself but herself, however, musically or melodically, and the accompaniment of the sax and the books as percussion emphasizes the centrality of sound. I'm doing this to highlight the sonic experience as something beyond text. In the same way, I suppose, as the play performed is a step beyond the mere reading of the play. The blues is a genre of the past. That is to say, unlike pop music, the icons of the blues and the voices of the blues are, in large part, deceased. The ecology of the blues then includes both race and nationality. The blues as a black genre, and with its African-American center, much like the Korean voice, asks us to think conjuncturally about whiteness and Americanness from within. These very terms are blowing up against, or within, or without, white, black, and yellow, English, American, and Korean. After the play's The Thing, the horn slows a bit as the poem ends. Although Hamlet chooses life in lieu of death, the uncertainty remains in the syntactical breakdown of single words. Sold, ring, singing, wrestling, men, ear, skulls, a rapier, poison, as well as the articulated pain in the voice. Soyoung leaves us not with conviction, but rather with fear and trepidation. In the second movement, which you're about to hear, the sound of Macbeth is a far angrier acoustomology. You'll hear that anger in a defamiliarizing song via Soyoung's voice and the sax, and as a sharpness in the horn. Moreover, the syntax of modern English will disappear, only to return in Shakespeare's lines, and in those, I think you'll hear the pain of a desiring self that knows not who, nor what he or she desires.
Spitting rage or a McFlurry. All the world's a stage. Yeah.
not light. See my black and deep desires.
Spitting Rage or a McFlurry. The title there alludes to anger and mass consumption. The weird sisters in the play trouble Macbeth's notion of time and space, much the way an ever-present media intrudes upon her very own presence via a new set of smartphone sounds, beeps, apple burps, bells, cacao talk audics, and whistles. The horn spits and stutters in staccato punctuation. The anger slides into song and then a language of polysyllabic enjambment before settling slightly into sex or unsexing. Sex as unsexing is an act of undoing, both by Lady Macbeth and by So Young. Remember Lady Macbeth's "Hie thee hither." The Asian Korean female queers the white English male Macbeth. So Young inverts notions of the Asian female as passive by articulating power and fear, pleasure and pain, in ways that trouble the binary. While I don't see Macbeth as sexless, and I do hear sex in the groove of the horn, the pounding of the books, and the yearning in the vocal delivery, it feels like what's happening here involves power and gender. The movement ends with Shakespeare's quotation all by itself, voiced in emotional pain and depth. "Stars Hide Your Fires" reminds me, too, of that fourth single by the band Mumford & Sons, "Roll Away Your Stone," released in 2010. That's a modernized version in which the voice is delivered as a multi-voiced polysyllabic roar. The Mumford & Sons also use the bard and Much Ado About Nothing in particular in Sign No More, their title track to their 2009 debut album. And while I might offer the song or perhaps that record as its own sounding of Shakespeare, I want to use this example to speak briefly of class. 1 year before Mumford & Sons' Sign No More was released, Taylor Swift released Love Story in 2008, her own reworking of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, to both critical and commercial success. And we can see in these two acts, albeit perhaps at opposite ends of the spectrum, the continued use of Shakespeare in popular art. Shakespeare's both high and low art, amazingly at the same or nearly the same time. Intellectual indie rock, commercial pop country rock. I use the blues here in sounding Shakespeare's soul as a way to complicate the youth, the whiteness, and the Anglo-American resonance, even as I want the blues in Shakespeare to rub up against, remember the ecology, and inhabit a sonic space that goes beyond the indie rock, country rock, pop conundrum. In the third movement, on Othello, sadness proliferates. So Young speaks Iago's and Othello's lines across the poem, scattered amidst words and ideas raised by the play. Iago is silenced at the end of the play, and the repetition of the horn and the high peals are attempts to get at the movement of that choice, of that pain, that silences the cunning voice of the interlocutor par excellence. Again, the male voice is manifest here as the female and as Korean.
Iago's eye or Iago's sigh.
Beast with two backs.
beyond and through Roseanne. I may not breathe my censure what he might be. If what he might he is not, I would to heaven he were.
Iago's eye, or Iago's sigh, in the world, about me. This poem includes snippets from Iago and Othello, but not Desdemona nor Amelia, and I hope to get at the sadness of a character who chooses silence in the end. The me is articulated by Iago and articulates Othello, both of whom are self-silenced, or silence themselves, by both suicide and choice, as well as so young, you and even me, the performer and the listener. The question of the voice, who is speaking, thinking, writing, being, raises the notion of embodiment. Jacques Derrida wants to destabilize the voice so as to replace it with and privilege the text. There are plenty of critics who challenge Derrida, the aforementioned Smith and Paul Zumthor and a host of others. Indeed, the field of sound studies and the subject of hearing raises all sorts of questions and answers about the voice, whose, where, and what it does. For more on the voice and embodiment right here in Sounding Out, be sure to check out Mark Brantner's Sound and Sanity, Rallying Against the Voice, Tara Betts on the difference in the black female voice as icon in contemporary rap, in her They Do Not Sound Alike, sampling Kathleen Cleaver, Asata Shakur, and Angela Davis, and even Jenny Stover Ackerman's on the lower frequencies, Norman Corwin, Colorblindness, and the Golden Age of U.S. Radio. To return to Iago's eye, or Iago's sigh, the sound of Iago's silence is in part the sound of the self in pain, the sound of the self-envisioned world crashing down upon one's own head, crashing down upon one's own head, both Iago's, even Othello's, and yes, our own. I hear this pain in the B blues scale and the ending of the poem in a low D. The sonic fall from the high register to the low mirrors the awareness and recognition of the self discovering and choosing silence. Carousel on the Books comes in just briefly, and again Shakespeare's lines are delivered without accompaniment in the space of silence. Critically, race in Shakespeare is a relatively recent topic. Discussions of Othello and blackness, although they began to appear in the 1960s amidst the civil rights movement and black power era, didn't really take hold until the late 1980s and early 1990s. And I'm thinking here of Anaya Lumba's Renaissance Drama, published in 89, that book, Emily Bartel's article, Making More of the Moor, from 1990, and Michael Neal's On Proper Beds from 1989, and then his Mulattoes, Blacks, and Indian Moors from 1998. There are lots of others. Iago's sigh offers a female articulation of Iago, Othello, you, me, with a Korean inflection of longing. While the listener cannot see So Young voicing them, us, she and he, you and me, we can hear her, and our hearing includes race. For Koreans, the people of a divided nation, the pain is known as Han, and is best represented in the indigenous Korean folk art, Pansori. Can we hear the Han in Soyoung? In the collective consciousness of blackness, would we hear a pain or a rupture in the voice of a black actor that might separate that voice from the Asian voice or from whiteness? Out of these questions about voicing pain comes the final movement in the play of Lear, Insanity, Power, Inheritance, The Shocking, and Death.
Learing. Rain.
Valerian. And there you have it. I know no answer. So Young embodies Cordelia as she articulates Cordelia's lines four times amidst 14 lines that lack syntactical sense, save the Shakespeare. Sounding Shakespeare's Soul began with snippets or phrases of Shakespeare within modern grammar. As we heard in the ending, however, Shakespeare's English supplants a nonsensical contemporary syntax. Returning to acoustomology, my hope is that the sounds help move the listener into being, particularly through the sax, melody, singing, and the rhythm, in conjunction with a sort of knowing. As for our knowing, I like to break down knowledge into a tripartite ecology as offered up by Raymond Williams. I hear the dominant discourse here as the sax, the blues, and the voice above and beyond the spoken word. A moment wherein musicality works particularly well is So Young's eruption into song in McFlurry, with "Why so bloody?" and also "And what does it mean?" The emerging discourse is something that really manifests in the end with the breakdown of language or the defamiliarizing of contemporary English. 100 villains lie, sins 50 leer, to shear and pluck your beard fooling. And in Shakespeare's verse rendered familiar and unfamiliar, we have the residual discourse. Remember the vocals. All alone by themselves, stars hide your fires, and I would to heaven he were, those vocals left bare. The triplicate nothing, my lord, as male, female, American, English, Korean, also highlights Shakespeare's simplicity, his presence and complication all at the same time. So Young queers the male voice as a desiring of the male voices, really, as desiring and a desirable female voice that is both raced Asian and nationalized Korean, and also as the other. In feeling terms, the dominant discourse is delight and joy, a sense of knowing in the body. The emerging, rage and anger or frustration, perhaps with being, and the residual is fear and uncertainty, in part the problem of language and the soul. The final movement, leering, wields syntactically out-of-whack English with a groovy beat and swinging horn. Hey-ho, the grin down the main is a nod to the song the fool sings, a song Shakespeare also used in Twelfth Night. Early modern ballads, perhaps like our blogs and online media today, provided 16th and 17th century Londoners an acoustomology rich in music and information. The performance of plays then, at that time, in the early modern period, would include and be informed by the musical ecology of the ballads and the broadsides. For more on this, check out Bruce Smith's The Acoustic World of Early Modern England, as already mentioned, and also Patricia Fumerton's, Anita Guarini's, and Chris Maccabee's Ballads and Broadsides in Britain, 1500 to 1800, that was published in 2010. You can also see and hear samples at the UC Santa Barbara English Broadside Ballad Archive, directed by Patricia Fumerton. That's available online. Just type in UC Santa Barbara English Broadside Ballad Archive. The insanity in Lear is well wrapped in melody, along with a storm, as is sounding Shakespeare's Soul. I hope you heard it and enjoyed it too. I've seen a number of Shakespeare productions here in Seoul over the past several months. Young Jung-woon's A Midsummer Night's Dream and his Shippiya, or Twelfth Night. Kim Kwon's Shippiya, or romantical musical drama, Twelfth Night. And Park Jung-hee's Deokdo Dai, One Man Show, or Macbeth, One Man Show. And the question of an international Shakespeare is being answered in these very performances. I find Shakespeare being welcomed into Korean theater in new and very fascinating ways. Yang, Park, and Kim's Shakespeare speaks and sounds Korean. They're in Korean. But yes, Shakespeare's still therein, in Seoul. Wrapping up, I'd like to think this experience is helping us to get at what Gail Kern-Pastor calls the ensouled body. Pastor and others like Mary Floyd Wilson, Catherine Rowe, Tanya Pollard, and Michael Schoenfeld, to name only a few, work on the early modern body in ways that are really prescient to us today. To the matter at hand, however, I listened hard there in hopes of hearing the bard. Did you listen as hard here? I hope you liked what you heard again. This work was supported by the Hankuk University of Foreign Studies Research Fund of 2013. I want to thank Hwang So-young for her fabulous vocal contribution, Charismatic for her sound anchor on the books, Jenny Stover-Ackerman for the green light at the get-go, and Aaron Chermel, along with everyone at Sounding Out, for the wonderful work they're doing in sound studies today. Please check out Sounding Shakespeare's Soul in its entirety on the blog, Sounding Out. Comments and feedback would, of course, be most appreciated. Thank you.